in terms of the way I'm going to deal with the meetings, I'm basically only, wherever these leaders have put out things publicly that they met with us, I'll confirm that we met them. In the case of Prime Minister Olmert, which, you know, they said this was his first meeting since Annapolis, which I thought was helpful to kind of gauge him. He said that everything could be used on the record. So I will refer to the Olmert meeting on the record, but otherwise I'll only refer to leaders to the extent they allowed us, they made their comments or that they met us in the Jordanian newspapers or at the like. In terms of key findings, so let me begin with Jordan. And I would say here there were like, and I'll try to make these in bullet points and not to take up too much time. There's an Iran slash moderate Arab versus moderate Arab bloc section. There's Syria, and there's the issue of the Islamists in Jordan, and there's the issue of Annapolis. I would just say on Iran, the people we spoke to, and I could say that they were, you know, very high up. They were people who kept saying whether the Iranians have nukes or not, were very worried about them. And this was, I think, a key theme that emerged, and a real sense of concern that the Arab world was not galvanizing to really contain Iran. And I think there was a very kind of candid assessment on what could be done, but not belief that it wasn't being done in the region. I got a feeling that for Jordan, there are really two key building blocks in trying to create this containment approach. One was its closer ties with Saudi Arabia. For Jordan, one top official said he made 150 trips. I'm sure this was a use that was a little exaggerated, but I think it was illustrative in the last year to really work on Saudi-Jordanian relations and really to try to get the Saudis to use their oil revenues in ways that would be very helpful in containing Iran. Many people like to quote the king as saying, when you're dealing with the octopus of Iran, you have to cut off the tentacles. And it was clear that Jordan favored a much more kind of active approach, call it a regional containment approach, whether it's supporting proxies that they view as anti-Iranian, and like Sinjar in Lebanon, like Abu Mazen in the West Bank, or different elements in Iraq. That if you want to deal with Iran, you had to deal with this kind of regional kind of containment. One senior person went much further in feeling that Iran had to be dealt with more militarily, forcefully by the United States, and kind of got very explicit about that. I should say that was before the NIE was released, but the person kept saying that it was irrespective of the nuclear issue. And I think that they just feel that the Arabs are marginalizing themselves, as they like to say, and that if there's going to be a moderate bloc, it better start forming together, and Jordan sees its role as kind of a catalyst in that regard. And that brings us to Syria, and it actually follows up with from Soner's remarks. And I think if there's, you know, one takeaway that I took away was hearing what Soner said about Turkey, hearing what the Jordanians say about Syria, and hearing what the Israeli Defense Establishment says about Syria, you could almost close your eyes and you'll be hearing the same thing. And you don't know who said what when, because there seems to be a consensus among them. Basically, for King Abdullah to go to Damascus on the eve of Annapolis didn't just happen. It seems like there had been many preparatory visits to Damascus to get the Syrians to yes. The trips of Jordanians were coordinated with the Saudis and the United States. And basically, the Jordanian thesis is that the Iranian-Syrian relationship is reversible. And that was a key takeaway for me from this trip. They believe that when you present the counter-argument, which says, hey, you know, these people have been together with Iran since 1980, with the Iran-Iraq war, this isn't a relationship that's going to be replaced overnight. If the Iranians don't give them weapons, who's going to step in for the Syrians? And you always keep hearing that how the Syrians are chafing being the junior partner in this Iranian-Syrian relationship. That in 1980, at the start of the Iran-Iraq war, when they were when they had that relationship with Hafez al-Assad, there was more of a relationship of equals. But given the oil revenue and a lot of other factors, this is not an equal relationship today, and it's not something that Damascus relishes. So basically, the Jordanian position, as I understood it, was you can't isolate everybody in the Middle East. If you want to isolate Iran, if you want to isolate Hamas, if you want to isolate Hezbollah, you have to deal with Syria. And as a matter of fact, if I can recall, Sam Lewis is here. I remember a conversation, talk I gave, I think it was at Brookings in the summer, and he said, look, if we're serious people about Hamas, then we got to get serious on dealing with Syria. So I remember that, Sam. So I think that seems to be very much the Jordanian view. They seem to dangle, I don't know to the extent they were explicit, some Saudi money if the Syrians kind of change sides, so to speak. They kept saying, we're not at the quid pro quo stage. We're more telling them what they have to do if they want to change sides. Now, again, I don't know. I hope I haven't been working in the Middle East too long that you begin to start resembling some of the conspiratorial thinking of some people there. But, you know, I don't know if it's a non-deal deal, and I defer to David Schenker and others who are bigger experts than I am in the whole Lebanon issue. But I found it interesting that the very time that the Syrians were saying they were going to go to Annapolis, and right after the king went, all of a sudden the forces of March 14th said they were going to accept Michel Suleiman, a compromise candidate from the Lebanese, I think, chief of staff, who March 14th was kind of cool on. All of a sudden they said, okay, we'll accept him as our candidate in Lebanon. Was there a quid pro quo? Rice clearly wanted the Syrians in the tent, because the Jordanians wanted them in the tent, the Saudis wanted them in the tent. Was this a quid pro quo? If it, you know, the vote still hasn't happened. I don't think people say tomorrow. I've heard different days. And it's been postponed so many times, you know, it isn't done till it's done. But it's just kind of curious and coincidental that these things seem to be happening at the same time, if that does happen. But maybe it'll fall apart, because that's also the Middle East. So that was, you know, they thought in their meetings with the Syrians that not Asaf Shokat, the brother-in-law, was at the intelligence meeting, representing the intelligence agency, but Ali Mamluk, a different Syrian intelligence official. And, you know, the Jordanians were open in saying they've now had subsequent Syrian-Jordanian intelligence exchanges after the king's visit. And now we saw Walid Mu'allam was just in Amman, you know, too. Rob also follows Jordan much closer than I do, so he may have a dissenting view. But I was struck by how much Jordan has put in this basket. They view itself as the, are they doing this as the representative of the United States? Are they doing it because they feel the U.S. isn't acting? But clearly they believe that the steps they took were coordinated with the Saudis and with the Bush administration in making this approach to Syria. They clearly hope that if the Syrians are in the tent, that they will not allow Hamas to do some of the attacks in a post-Annapolis phase. That, again, we'll see soon enough. And we'll see how that channel is sustained. Let me go to the Islamists in Jordan, and I'll just speak very briefly on this. I felt that the two things that kind of jumped out at me. One was what one Jordanian official said was their mosque campaign, which I didn't read about in the United States. Maybe I missed those articles, very possible. That the minister of the Waqf in Jordan has systematically basically gone mosque to mosque in Jordan and has rooted out radical preachers. And as just, you know, I don't know if they've transferred them to administrative abilities or they gave them early retirement. I don't know. But it was I'm told it was a mosque-to-mosque campaign. And I think in many ways they probably feel they bore some of the harvest with the elections that was held the week before, where the Islamist representation, the Jordanian parliament, dropped sharply. You know, there will be some who say, no, it's, you know, the Mukhabarat, the General Intelligence Director in Jordan is very strong. Those weren't fair elections. I'm in no position to judge. The Jordanian spin on this was that all watching Al Jazeera and Arabia and a lot of the Arab channels and watching Hamas fire on killing seven people at that mass demonstration of 250,000 people in Gaza on the eve of the elections did not exactly endear them to the Jordanian public. And they lost because of that. They lost because of the pictures from June 14th of them throwing people off of rooftops in Gaza. and like this was not their image of Hamas, and that basically the Islamists in Jordan are paying a price because of Hamas's behavior in Gaza. And we heard this from everybody there of that sort of view. The thing that got very little attention, I found, I tried to push this with a number of people, and I found it was curious that it was kind of no one really wanted to talk much about it, were the Iraqi refugees in Jordan. Because when I was there in January, they were saying, you know, we're suffering, there's 750,000 Iraqi refugees, how are we going to cope? Yes, many of them stole money before the war, during the war, after the war in Iraq, and have 19 Iraqi restaurants with valet parking now in Amman. But we are suffering because of the stresses it's putting on public infrastructure, schools and medical facilities and cooking oil as well as supplies. But now people thought, no, the numbers were too high, our numbers are lower. And I was just kind of curious. I didn't really get good answers. I could have speculation why the Jordanians don't want to stress this as much. But they clearly feel they are paying a price. However number of Iraqi refugees there may be, they are paying a price for U.S. actions in Iraq. And while maybe too proud to ask for assistance, they did say how their efforts in the Hill have not gone too far in getting the financial assistance to Jordan to be updated. Annapolis was played up very much in the Jordanian press. When you get them to say, but aren't there all these problems in the post-Annapolis phase, they'll all say yes, but we don't, we're worried of people. If Annapolis fails, there'll be the despair and more pressure from people on the West Bank. By the way, voluntary pressure, not that Israel would do this, but people just would give up on the West Bank and come to the East Bank. So they were see themselves as cheerleaders for Annapolis. Now, on the Palestinian issue in Ramallah, it was, there I felt that that's when you got more in the nuts and bolts about Annapolis, not just as an idea, but as a reality. And here, too, everyone you talk to, I just came back from Annapolis, and they want to talk about that. But for the most part, I think the government of Salam Fayyad is very proud that this is the first Palestinian government that doesn't have the word resistance in its platform. That there's been, someone said 12 Palestinian governments. This is the first one that doesn't use that word. Israel interprets the word resistance as terrorism. This is the first government that doesn't have it. They say they've closed 150 Hamas charities and they've suspended, they say 1,000 others. I'm sure that word is not exact, although I'm told there's 1,053 mosques in the West Bank. They said, we've dissolved the Zakat as we know it. That's the charity system that Matt Levitt has written so much about. And they want it reviewed. They're hopeful for the donors conference coming up in Paris on December 17th. And they're very hopeful that the Saudis make a major contribution. The Jordanians and other non-Israelis think the Saudis are about to announce something big. My view is we'll see it when we believe it. And not just that they announce it, but they deliver. They promised $500 million to Dahlan, I believe, last year. They never delivered a penny on what they said. And as you know, as I've said here before, I don't want to belabor the point, oil revenues are triple what they were in 2003. Two things that emerged, I think, that were interesting, and we were told high level to raise this with Prime Minister Olmert, that I didn't really feel as much here. One was the issue of Carney. To what extent do the Palestinians, seeing the drop in living standards in Gaza, to what extent do they want to be involved? Clearly, the PA wants I think Hamas to feel squeezed. At the same time, they feel Hamas is taking care of their own people with cash being going in through tunnels and all sorts of things, and they're not caring for the people of Gaza. So I think they feel there's a precedent, there's an Erez crossing that the PA mans, which VIPs and medical humanitarian cases go through, and they would like to see if they could be in charge of a Carney crossing that would be run by the PA, and as a win-win, let Hamas turn it down, and we go up, and if Hamas lets us in, that's good for us too. But basically, the people being squeezed in Gaza are the business people, and not their own supporters, because they care for their own people. And they're not doing the grand social welfare, daycare in the mosques, all that stuff that got them elected. They're only now doing for their core supporters, not for their own, not for the broader Gaza public. So there was interest in this. And the other issue I raised with him was an idea of mine, I said, you know, I've been at this for years with the whole business of roadblocks. We can go round and round, round and round, round and round. I mean, I don't want to even bore you here how many times we've discussed this and how it's come up in different roadmaps and things like that. And Palestinians say movement, Israelis say security. And it never moves. And you'll find, well, Israel said, well, we took down three roadblocks in these villages. And the people said, well, they don't feel it. And then it doesn't build goodwill. My request was, what about instead of taking down roadblocks, you would add soldiers at the main roadblocks? So Israel would have the security it deserves, in my view. And the Palestinians could have expedited lines so they wouldn't have to wait, which is something that makes people feel worse. And this person said, we're for it. Double the number of soldiers. Do whatever it wants. Can you raise it with the Israelis? We would like that. So I raised it with Olmert, and Dennis raised one of the points with Olmert. And Olmert immediately said yes to both points, Carney and the roadblocks issue. And I must say, meeting Olmert, maybe I should really start with that, because him I could say on the record. I've never seen him so pumped up. It was almost like a football player who came out of a halftime huddle. And he came out as very passionate and very genuine. The audience did not have a lot of, they weren't expecting a lot. But he emerged as someone who really wants, you know, believes that if this is, the status quo is bad for Israel. And I passed around speeches that Olmert has been giving in Hebrew. I think five of them here, but there were more that, I thank Margaret for this, just the excerpts of things he's saying. And I think, to me, he's emerging as kind of an educator-in-chief about conditioning the societal landscape for compromise. I think Abbas gave a good speech in Annapolis, too. I'm not here to compare and contrast, but I think Olmert's giving these five speeches, and even speaking from Annapolis in Hebrew, I thought that was good. If Abbas could speak in Arabic, why shouldn't Olmert speak in Hebrew to his own people? But there's a lot of public skepticism that Annapolis is going to succeed. But if Olmert keeps going like this, I think his numbers and support for this process will emerge. If you look at the polling data, all Israelis like the idea that their leaders go to Annapolis, but they're skeptical that something's going to come out of it, just as the Palestinians are skeptical. So you have the first time since 1991, the leaders actually believe the other leader wants peace. We never had that in the Rabin-Arafat period. And what's new here, in my view, is that they do believe that. But now the question is, can this confidence spread to the publics? And here, I think, is the channel, and I'll conclude with this point. Specifically, I think the question is Olmert and working with Abbas and the United States, is he really going to be able to make a difference? I think the defense establishment in Tel Aviv is very skeptical of this. I think before the trip, I thought it was more about Ehud Barak. After the trip, I don't think it's as much about Ehud Barak as it is about the defense establishment itself. They were big supporters of Oslo at the beginning. Their confidence was shattered. They all think Abbas and Fayyad are genuine, but they believe it has to be much more incremental. And the question to me is, how does that kind of timetable work with Secretary Rice's timetable of trying to solve this whole conflict within a year? And I didn't meet anyone who thought that she could solve it within the year, because of this skepticism that it has to be done incrementally. I think there's a general view that you know, to build constituencies, people have to see things with their eyes on the ground, that the reality has changed. It's not enough to see Olmert and Abbas and coffees with Condi in these three-way meetings or in two-way sessions, but it has to be people seeing that today was different than yesterday and tomorrow could be different than today. And this, I think, creates a certain trap. I mean, how do you use this first phase in a way that builds confidence, it doesn't lead to mutual recriminations? I'm not, you know, when I see the appointment of General Jones, the NATO commander, I'm not sure he sees his view as the judge on the first phase of the roadmap, which is supposed to build confidence, but more as planning a long-term security exercise for the role of the Palestinian state in the regional security architecture of the Middle East. So who's going to judge if it's not him? And how's he going to judge if there's no agreed-upon criteria? Because the first phase of the roadmap was never negotiated by the parties. It was done by the quartet. These are big questions. And what I'm concerned is we're going to have what I call a lot of motion, but not a lot of movement. That we're going to see visits coming up of Welch, Rice, and Bush over the next month. And yet, for the public, it won't mean a lot if the realities on the ground don't change. And I think that's the conundrum of what, you know, is there going to be set criteria for judging the first phase? I do believe that's important, or else you won't have the constituencies to deal with the core issues. And I think that's a big question. I will just say on that point that, to me, you need some sort of a paradigm shifter that would make people think that there's something big going on and not just small things. I think would be big would be if Abbas and Fayyad, who people think are genuine, if they would announce, for example, that they're going to take, you know, deal seriously with the issue of incitement, Palestinian incitement, with the media and state-run media and the schools and the like. I think that would make a big impression on the Israeli public. And I think if the Israelis would do something on the roadblocks in a way that Palestinians don't have to wait in these long lines, and the Arab states, which are supposedly signed up for Annapolis, that they also are part of the mix, whether it's contributing money to the Palestinians, whether it's negotiating with the Israelis about normalization. Of course, they won't normalize till Israel signs a treaty. But they're asking Israel to do the third phase of the roadmap to negotiate now. There should be some sign that they're part of the solution and not part of the problem. So I left with a lot of questions. We left there the day the NIE started to leak. And I'll just say on, and one word on Syria, on the Israeli defense establishment, as skeptical as they were on the Palestinians, not that that Fayyad wasn't genuine, but that it would take time for him actually to implement this city by city. They've taken over security now in Nablus, kind of a day shift, night shift, that the Palestinians are there patrolling during the day, but the Israelis can go in at night. It's going to take time for this to go in all the different directions, in all the different cities. But on Syria, they were also all to a man. You could say, well, that Barak is identified with a kind of a Syria track approach. So maybe that filters down. It's possible. Olmert, when we asked him about negotiations with the Syria two-track, he said unequivocally he's for it. He just said implementation can't happen at the same time. It's just too much for us. So I don't know if that's genuine or not. I think that what you say, well, how can the defense establishment be more sanguine about the Syrians and the Palestinians? It's because they see in Syria central authority. And they think if you have central authority, you can impose security. If you don't have central authority, it takes time, step by step, to build it up. So that explains, I think, the differential. On Iran, because we left just as the NIE was coming out, but Olmert tried to caution us that, you know, there are many things could be done short of a full military strike. I think from what I'm reading now, and there's a lot of residue of bitterness over this. I would refer you to an article in the New Republic, I think, that came out over the weekend by Yossi Klein Halevi, interviewing the Israeli security establishment, feeling that the issue has not been framed appropriately, and it is ultimately very misleading. And this could lead to some very bad blood, I fear, between the top echelons, maybe not on the policy side, but on the other security side in the U.S. and Israel. This will have to see, you know, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is just there today. We'll see. This could take a long time to play out. We'll have to see. But if there was one optimistic note, I would just say that on the Palestinian point, was that everyone hoped that the combination of Salam Fayyad, a PhD economist, Tony Blair, who's devoted to the economic issue, and Saudi oil revenue, that there might be a way, given the small economy of the West Bank, to change the economic context that could make some of these other issues more protracted. But my experience says that without the security issue, you're not going to be able to do it fully. So this could improve things, could show Fayyad is delivering, and all the polls show Hamas is dropping, and the other guys are gaining, maybe not as much as Hamas is dropping, but gaining. The economics could be helpful, and I'm hopeful, but I don't think they'll be decisive without the security dimension. So thank you very much.